the guys from Ping, they've kind of shown me how much the equipment matters.
I just love that I can hit any shot I kind of want.
We're going to be able to tell some fun stories about what goes on here to help golfers play better golf.
Welcome back to the Ping Proving Grounds podcast. I'm Shane Bacon. That is Marty Jurtson, who apparently maybe just got a haircut. Looks really high and tight right now, my friend.
Ooh, summertime in Phoenix been rough, Shane. So, yeah, you got to keep it short in the summertime.
No reason to be messing with it. We got an exciting guest today, a man that is also in a warm climate right now, Joseph Mayo joining us, instructor for Discovery Properties based out of the Summit in Las Vegas, and another of a person much smarter than I am. So, Joseph, we appreciate you taking a little bit of time. And I was reading that you saw a TrackMan for the first time, and it kind of opened up your brain to this new world, and that's how you got back into golf. Can you take us back to that moment when you first saw a TrackMan and how it kind of opened up this world that is now your life?
Absolutely. And first of all, thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it. I got out of golf in around 2000 because I was so frustrated that, you know, there was no way to measure anything. There was no way to answer questions. There was no way to validate anything. And I got out of golf and I thought nothing of it. I never thought that I would be a part of golf again. And I can't remember exactly where we were, but my father was a cancer patient, still is. And we were in a physician's office at some point. And I picked up some type of a golfing magazine, don't remember what it was. And I heard about TrackMan Doppler radar. And that really, really made me go, wow. Maybe this is what I've been looking for. There was a doctor, anesthesiologist here in Las Vegas that knew me and liked me, and he believed in my abilities. I don't know why, but he did. And he said, "Hey, Joe, let's get a TrackMan." I'm like, "Wow, sure, let's go ahead and do that. I've got $500 in my checking account, so let's go ahead and get one." They were $26,000, and we got that thing. And you know, at that time, there's no internet forums. There's no user's manual. I mean, you're on your own. It's sink or swim. So I just plopped that bad boy down and I just let everybody come hit shots for me. And I started seeing all these patterns and began putting together ball flight, if you will. And I started to notice that, you know, no disrespect to those of the past, but I began to see that what we believe to be true was not true. And the golf ball did not start on the club path. It started, you know, as you guys know, basically where the face is pointed, not 100%, but basically. And I took that and I started putting videos on the internet, I don't know, 2010. And some people saw those videos. Grant Waite, as you guys know, PGA Tour player, saw it. And we developed a friendship. And literally, it changed my life.
Joe, I think you're kind of like a pioneer. You're the early adopter of TrackMan using 3D. You know, I think I'm a PGA of America member. Now I know the PGA of America knows that they have to level up their ball flight laws, so to speak, and everything that was taught there. You've influenced a lot of folks in using, you know, kind of bringing in 3D problem solving. You know, you've kind of taken that scientific method and applied it to golf. I think that's one of the things you've inspired so many, not only helped so many golfers, but inspired a lot of golf teachers to open their eyes to that. So I feel like you've reached a lot of folks. Who were some of the other teachers? I know you just talked about figuring out a lot of this on your own because there was no instruction manual, but who are some of the teachers, PhDs, academics, whoever, because you have not been afraid to, you know, reach out and make a phone call and ask questions. That's what I love about you. Who are some of those folks that have helped you along this journey level up your knowledge?
That is a great question. I have bugged you guys at Ping, as you know, for the last 10 years. you have been an invaluable resource. Paul Wood. I call Paul to hear his accent. You know, I don't really care what he says. I want that sexy accent that he's got. Eric Hingerson there, of course. Also, Dr. Sasha McKenzie. I have bugged the daylights out of him. Dr. Young-Hoo Kwon. Down in Dallas, Texas, I've bugged him about biomechanics as well, and I'm sure I'm leaving others out. But I don't ever want to make it sound like I did this on my own, because that is absolutely not true. And you guys at Ping have been an invaluable resource, and I really appreciate your help and support over the last 10 years.
Joe, I was interested in something you said. You said when you started to dive into TrackMan numbers, everything that had been kind of thought about in terms of the golf swing was either incorrect or maybe misevaluated, or maybe it was just simply wrong. What was wrong about the way we thought about the way golfers hit it, pros hit it, and what have you changed in terms of the minds of some of the people in and around golf, instructors, professional golfers, that you feel like is now something everybody agrees on or believes in?
Well, believe it or not, I don't think we still have a consensus. People will still send me screenshots of people on the internet, you know, saying hit down to make it go up, which we know is that's silly. That doesn't happen. The ball starts on the club path, which we know that doesn't happen, except in very, very specific cases. And I don't think it still starts on the path. It might become 50-50 or 55-45. But without question, the number one ball flight issue was the golf ball starts where the path of the club is and it curves toward the face. And that is dead wrong. As we know, that's absolutely backwards. It starts basically where the face is pointed. And it actually curves away from the club path, assuming the face hit. I think one of the biggest revelations of TrackMan for the masses, and it should be the biggest revelation, is how the angle of attack can be judge, jury, and executioner. And I remember, 12 years ago, this is 2023, right, guys? 12 years ago, minimum, when I did a video where I said, if your angle of attack changes from down of, you know, i.e. iron to driver, and you're trying to hit the same shot, you cannot be aimed in the same place.
Yes.
When you start thinking of the three-dimensional aspect of ball flight, the three-dimensional aspect of the club movement, you know, we've been told for 100 years that you got to have good grip, good stance, good posture, but you got to have good alignment. And I don't know what good alignment is, because the best players in the world are aimed all over the place.
Yep.
And I'd like to give just a quick little synopsis. If someone wants to hit a nice little draw with a 7-iron, right-handed golfer, well, we know that the club face needs to be pointed somewhere right of the flag at impact to start it there. And we know the club path needs to be slightly right of that face to make it curve back to the hole. That's what we know. Well, ball sitting on the ground and with a 7-iron, it should be. That means that golf club is going to be moving down toward that golf ball, but it's going to be moving out to the right some amount. And that out helps us produce the path that we need to hit a draw. It does. So what I'm getting at is, with that 7-iron, it's very reasonable. It's very plausible for the golfer to have good old-fashioned straight railroad track alignment, because the down helps the out, which helps the draw. Next thing you know, he goes to the next tee box, he tees up a driver, and he wants to hit that same draw. Well, now his angle of attack is up. Let's say it's up 2 or 3, which is very plausible as well.
Yep.
He cannot have that same alignment, because with the 7-iron, the down produced the out, which helped him. But now with the driver, the up produces a leftward path, which does not help him. So now you got to ask yourself two questions. A, are we going to change his upward angle of attack? And I would say, heck no. Not with modern golf, not with the modern equipment. No, we want to launch this thing in the air. That's a good thing. It's a healthy thing. So if we're not going to change the angle of attack being upward, how are we going to defeat the leftward club path, which is actually our enemy? The answer is, we're going to aim to the right.
Yep.
And this is what I say. I've been saying it for 10 years. You have to aim right enough to counteract the left created by the up.
Yeah, Joe, I think like Rory's a good example of that. You've seen him aim his irons look like railroad, and then he gets to the driver and, you know, looks like he's aiming 30 yards right sometimes.
Victor Hovland comes along and just throws the monkey wrench in the whole darn thing, and he aims right and hits cuts. I mean, so there you go. You know, you've got Rory McIlroy, what is he in the world rankings now, number 3, and he's aimed to the right and drawing it. You got Victor, number 4 in the world, aiming right and cutting it. You're like, oh my God, what's going on? So at the end of the day, the bottom line is this. In my opinion, every modern instructor not only should know this stuff, in my opinion, he must know this stuff. He must understand the three-dimensional travel of that golf club.
Joe, I think it's pretty fun with Victor. You know, we had him on the podcast. We talked to him, you know, between Olympia Fields and when he won that tour championship. And he was describing some of his best iron shots and working the ball, shifting his baseline, shifting his alignments. I mean, what is it like to have a player like Victor that's really adopted understanding 3D geometry, 3D delivery, but then he can bring it onto the course with his feels? You know, how do you marry having that technical side of things with, okay, I'm an athlete, I got to hit this shot, I'm winning the biggest tournament in the world?
Well, first of all, Victor is an extremely intelligent kid out of golf. He's very inquisitive. And I've always believed that the sign of intelligence is not what you say that you know. It's the questions that you ask. And Victor is an extremely good question asker. And he keeps me on my toes. And I'll be completely honest with you. Working for Victor is demanding because he wants answers now. He actually wants them 5 minutes ago. And he wants correctness. And if you not that I have pal, but I can tell you, if you try to slot something by him that just doesn't pass muster, you're going to hear about it. And so he's a smart kid, which is good for me because you know me, guys. I like to get a little technical at times and talk about wrist angles and tilts and all that kind of good stuff. And he loves it. He eats that stuff like candy. But at the end of the day, make no mistake about it. What you have seen out of Victor the last 2 weeks specifically, what you've seen this year, it's not been some magical, mythical golfing phenomenon that I've brought him through teaching. You're just simply dealing with a Ferrari. You're dealing with an absolute world-class primetime player. And as I said in an interview I did a few days ago with PGA Tour International, all he needed was a little good math and a little good science. Mm-hmm. This is what I told Victor when we started. I said, with your talent level, with your ability level, if my information is correct, if what I'm telling you is correct, then we must see results. There can be no other way. And if we're not seeing results, then most likely what I'm telling you is not valid. And guys, not to fluff my feathers, but what I have told him to do, he has caught on to it immediately. You guys have seen the results. The golfing world has seen the results. And one last little snippet. We did not begin short game until Riviera on Tuesday. He had a photo shoot on Monday. We started on Tuesday. And he and his caddy Shea were standing there, and his agent Butler Melnick were standing there with me. And I looked at him and I said, guys, this isn't going to take long. This ain't going to take long. And I'm not so sure they believed me, but I believed not in what I'm saying. I believe that he could do it. And as you guys have heard me say before, anybody that can take a 4-iron and put it on the back of a ball at 105 miles an hour and hit a shot dead straight from 250 yards away to a flag, don't tell me he can't chip a golf ball. Don't tell me that he can't pitch a golf ball, because I don't accept that theory. I don't accept that hypothesis that this kid can't chip a golf ball.
Yeah.
And now the world is seeing that he can.
Yeah. Joe, it kind of reminds me a little bit of, you know, Tiger had those struggles a little bit with chipping. It's not a confidence thing. He doesn't need like a sports psychologist. He needs like mechanics. He needs to improve the kinetics, you know what I mean, what he's feeling. So give a little overview there of those changes in the 3D delivery and maybe some of the angular rates, right, of Victor's short game, you know, before and after some of these changes that we're making, you know, angle of attack, delivery, things of that nature.
Sure. Well, first and foremost, it is my opinion, I stress opinion, that people are bad chippers, or they become bad chippers, because they hit the ground too soon and or incorrectly. And Victor Hovland, it was a living embodiment of hitting the ground too soon and hitting it incorrectly. He had them both going on. He had double whammies. And the more he would stick it in the ground, and the more he would lay the sod over it, and the more he would flub it, the more he believed he was too steep.
Yeah.
I'm not engaging the bounce. Oh, my God, I've heard engage the bounce for 2 million times. I've heard that. And he believed that he was too steep. Well, as Marty, as you know, that was absolutely incorrect. And all things being equal, a steep angle of attack moves the low point more forward. And if the low point is more forward, or shall we say contact with the ground?
Yeah.
Because contact with the ground is not necessarily your low point. I'm just trying to keep it simple for our viewers, our listeners. So As the angle of attack becomes more steeper, all things being equal, the low point becomes more forward. Well, if the low point or the contact point with the ground is more forward, then that means I'm not chili dipping it anymore. That means I'm not fatting it anymore. It means I'm catching ball first. And make no mistake about it, when you are trying to chip at the PGA Tour, well, when you're trying to chip at any level, if you cannot accurately predict contact, if you cannot accurately predict the speed of the ball off of that face, you cannot chip. And you sure as heck cannot chip at the tour level. So what I did was I said, no, you're not too steep, you're too shallow. We started moving the angle of attack dramatically more down. When he came to me, his angle of attack on a chip or a pitch was 3 or 4 degrees down. And now it's 12. He can stand there and rip them all day long with his eyes closed now, because what the technique has allowed him to do is catch good solid contact with a high frequency, which allows him to predict what the ball is going to do before he hits it. And if you think about it in common sense terms, that's the good sauce. That's the secret to chipping, is being able to predict what the ball is going to do. And with that steep angle of attack, now that low point is dramatically more forward, which increases the probability of a solid hit. That's all he needed, guys. And unfortunately, he was told, well, you can't chip if your wrist angle is like that going back. Well, we know that's true because Jordan Spieth does it, and Dustin Johnson does it, and Brooks Koepka does it. And the last time I checked, they're all major champions. They were all number one in the world. When I showed him those videos of those guys doing that, there was like a light bulb moment. He was like, wow. Because all this time he had been trying to roll that wrist in the backswing, cup that wrist. No one had ever said, no. Let's get the bottom vector of spin loft, which for the viewers out here, that's the angle of attack.
Mm-hmm.
Let's work on the bottom vector, which moves the low point forward, which allows you to predict contact. Because Marty, this is what I believe to be true. When we're talking spin loft, and you know, Victor had that little spin loft thing on the interview the other day. He said he learned spin loft. Well, as we know, spin loft is just an angle. You got the angle of attack on the bottom. You got the dynamic loft on the top. In my opinion, the bottom vector is where the money's made.
Mm.
Anybody can have a good top vector. I can. Just open the face. That points the top vector up in the air. Just open the face.
Yep.
But bottom vector, that's where the money is made, and that was his problem. And in my opinion, it is the problem when people cannot chip and pitch. They don't have the low point or the contact point with the ground far enough forward. Therefore, they're hitting the ground too soon, and then they're hitting it incorrectly. And after about 10,000 unsuccessful attempts, then you start doing things to not hit the ground, and that's when this thing can get sideways quickly.
Yes. Yeah.
Joe, I was just going to ask, how did you guys get in contact? Like, what was that initial introduction like to start to work together?
I called him. He needed to loan me money when not to play poker with. I needed a loan. So that's when I called him, though. I'm just kidding.
Well, hey, listen, now you can call him. And I think he'd probably give you that loan pretty quick.
No, he won't give it to me. Or he'll charge me 20% interest. So no, no. The Bank of Hovland is closed up. No, not getting in there. I've known Victor now 5 years, give or take. Met him when I went to Oklahoma State. Coach Bratton and Coach Dar out there had me out there to do a little chatting with them. I met him then, and we stayed in contact. But Victor contacted me in late 2019. I believe it was October. He sent me his swings, and I did a video analysis like this. It was like a 20-minute analysis where I was preaching to him. And guys, this is the honest truth. I sent that video analysis to Coach Brighton and Coach Dar because I wanted complete transparency. I wanted everyone to hear what I was saying to this kid. I told him, if I'm not mistaken, I told him 5 times in that video, stay away from golf instruction. Stay away from golf, including me. Stay away. You are going elite. It's a matter of time. And I said, you need a good caddy and a good lawyer, not a good golf pro. So he decided to come out and see me in November of 2019, and we went out to TPC Summerlin. And he just put on a ball-hitting exhibition. He's hitting 4 irons off the ground. He's barely touching the turf, launching this thing 240, straight as you can point. He pulled out the driver, and he's hitting it out there 320 yards with a 2-yard cut. And when it was over, he said, what do you think? I think that you don't need a golf instructor is what I think. And we went back to my house that night, and I had a little bourbon, and I said, Victor, you're a great kid. I want to be your friend. And I said, if you want to drink bourbon, if you want to play poker, that's fine. I'm your guy. But we're not going to do golf instruction. We're not going to do that. So as an instructor, guys, as an instructor, I knew that I had a generational talent sitting in front of me. I knew that I had a player sitting in front of me that, quote unquote, could take me places. He could take me places. I was not going to have that. I was not going to allow that. He did not need my help. He did not need instruction, in my opinion. And I told him no. And that's a factual statement. If you ask Victor, he'll tell you that. And then he went on his way. And fast forward to December, he calls me and says, Joe, would you take a look at some swings? And I did. And when I saw them, I hit redial immediately. Mm. I said, Victor, what on earth is going on? And I gave him some preliminary thoughts on what to do. He was not extending his hips nearly fast enough. We'll just keep it there to make it short and sweet. Had some success. Comes out to see me in Las Vegas. We go out to the Summit Club. And when he called me in December, his angle of attack with a 7-iron was almost 9 degrees down. 8.5 degrees down. And as I said 5 minutes ago, when that angle of attack is down, that's trying to push the path to the right. He's trying to hit cuts, path's moving to the right. And the more he tried to swing out into the left, the more the angle of attack went down, which the path went to the right. He was a cat chasing its tail. He couldn't get the path left of the face. When he comes out to Vegas and I get him to extend his hips, angle of attack goes to 4 degrees down immediately. And now he can get the path over to the left of the face and start cutting the ball. But the big deal was I sent him down to Dallas, Texas to see my good friend, John Sinclair. And Marty, I know you know John.
Mm-hmm.
And I trust John Sinclair implicitly when it comes to 3D capture, specifically with AMM 3D, which in my opinion, as of today, it's the best. It's the best we have today. And John is the best with that. And never forget what I'm about to say. For you instructors out there, if you ever are fortunate enough to teach a player of this caliber, you must get 3D. You must. Because the camera will lie to you. Your eyes will lie to you. And if you didn't need 3D, there would be no such thing. But I knew that dealing with Victor and dealing with a player of this caliber, I had to know. I sent him down there. My suspicions were confirmed. Not to say, wow, Joe, you're right. But my suspicions were confirmed, which allowed me to then proceed further down the road of helping him. And there is no way that I'm going to touch the golf swing of a player at this level without knowing what I'm doing. And the way to know what you're doing is to get the 3D.
Yeah, Joe, I like to think about that as like, you know, maybe you fall, you got an injury on your arm. Ah, it looks bruised. Let's take an X-ray. That might be what you can do with your launch monitor. But then you got to get an MRI, right? And then, you know, so that's kind of the spectrum. You know, you're not going to treat that without getting the MRI. And that's where I think, you know, the future is very bright for the everyday golfer because more and more of that technology is coming, right? And we're using things like learnings from our focal, our 3D motion system, which is very focused on what the club is doing, and passing along insights from there to the everyday golfer. One interesting thing, Joe, I wanted to ask you about Victor was he has the lowest, you know, there's a lot of different ways we can define closure rate, but he has the lowest closure rate of any of our tour players we've measured. This means like coming in from P6, shaft parallel to the ground to impact, that face is already relatively square. And it's only closing like 20 degrees from P6 to impact, where we have one of our other tour players, it might be 40, 50 degrees right in there, right? What is the relation between Victor's unique wrist angles and that closure rate? And then my related to that, Joe, is like, you know, how do you tie what he does in his full swing to his short game? And maybe that could come second to that question.
Well, the first answer, touching on rate of closure, yes, he is. When John Sinclair measured, it's the lowest I've ever measured. And John's database is probably 200 players, 200 tour players.
Yeah.
I want to make it perfectly clear. I had nothing to do with this rate of closure stuff. I had nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
I'm not so certain any instructor alive can touch into that. As you know, Marty, rate of closure is a touchy subject, how it's measured.
Yes.
But let's be fair. Let's be honest. There are world-class players who have a high rate of closure.
Yes.
There are. And the key word is rate. So if you look at a player that has this big swivel after impact, that doesn't mean they had a high rate of closure. Because they could have been closing this thing all the way down, which means the rate is not quick. The rate was slow. The total amount of closure was great, but the rate of closure was high. But as far as Victor's concerned, Marty, I had nothing to do with it. How he learned to do that. Go ahead, Marty.
Could just be how he grew up playing and what those risk conditions are and how that kind of relates. I think related to that, Joe, would just be, you know, and you talked about his wrist angles and what you've seen. He's given him permission to play with a certain wrist condition in his short game. Has that helped Mary now that he's performing so good with short game and full swing together at the same time?
I think it's absolutely critical because, as I told you before, you know, everyone wanted him to roll that forearm and cup that wrist. That's 180 degrees against his DNA. How are you supposed to step up on a green at Augusta National on Sunday at the Masters and roll your forearm, cup your wrist, roll the face wide open and hit a chip shot off of that tight lie on national television trying to win a green jacket? It's not going to happen. And as I said, when he saw the videos of Dustin Brooks and Jordan, it gave him the freedom mentally to say, wait a minute, this is okay.
Yeah.
And this is what I told him. I said, if you want the face open, just open the darn thing in a dress. Just lay it wide open on the bunker, lay it flat in the bunker, open the face in a dress. And I think without question, part of his success of being able to pick up on this stuff was I did not tamper in any way with grip, form rotations, and wrist angles. I did not. So any of the little finite moves that he's making, that's on him.
Yeah.
I didn't touch it.
Joe, I was interested in something you said earlier about the golf swing, like when we first started, about how there's so many unique ways to do this now and how we're learning so much more about the golf swing. There was a time, you know, around the 2000s with Tiger. It was Tiger. It was Adam Scott. And it was this perfect move, right? Everybody's got to have this perfect move. Are we going towards a world where the best in the world's golf swings are all going to look relatively different, considering guys like Victor can kind of do it in a different way than a Rory does it or a Brooks does it and be just as effective?
I don't think we're going in that direction. I think we're already there.
Okay.
We've always been there. Jack Nicklaus and Lee Trevino looked nothing alike. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And Rory looks nothing like Victor. Victor has a little John Rahm-y stuff going on, and you'll just a little bit.
Right.
The only thing they've got in common is they're holding on to a golf club hitting the ball. I think now with 3D and with information being released, it's helping the instructor understand what's going on and say, you know what? It's okay to be different. And I'm just going to go on the record right now. With Victor Hovland, anybody that tampers with that gross motor pattern, that overall gross motor pattern, that signature that he has, you should be horsewhipped because you are looking at a world-class machine. And guys, what I've done with him has been minimalistic.
Yeah.
And I just try to put him back to what he used to be. That's all, nothing more. And I want to stress, the credit goes to the kid.
Yeah.
My involvement in this was, you know, like I said, just a little bit of math, just a little bit. But that you're looking at a finely tuned machine. And I also want to say, if we had a clone of Victor, if we had Victor A and Victor B, and they're both standing on the range hitting balls, and Victor B cosmetically looks like Victor A, that doesn't mean Victor B is going to play like Victor A.
Mm.
The cosmetics are just that part of it. When we start talking about kinetics, then you've got to ask yourself, what about the emotional component that Victor has to play golf under this tremendous pressure? There is not an instructor on the face of this earth that can teach that.
Joe, I want to talk a little bit about friction. So you mentioned Victor's more down now, and he's getting more predictability out of his shot. So in my mind, from the physics of it, it's a double whammy. It's you get more predictability of where he's going to land that club or the low point or the interaction between the ball and the face. And the other one that compounds that and adds to it is you get better predictability of the coefficient of friction.
Yeah.
So we kind of define that as mu. We've talked about this thing mu. Victor and I, me and you and Victor have this funny running joke going about it. But the more you hit down, the less time you have to pick up water, debris, get grass between the ball and the face. He's also switched to our glide wedges. So we have a hydro pearl finish, which sheds the water. It's hydrophobic and this type of stuff. Overall, we're just kind of compounding the alignments with having a better predictability of the friction. And I think that's also, as a player, what's put you at ease, right? It's that unpredictability that can kind of drive you crazy with the short game, right?
100%, Marty. Well said, because think of it like this, guys, because now that he can predict contact, now that the bottom vector is doing its job, now he can predict spin loft, which, as we know, the spin loft predicts ball speed and spin rate.
Yeah.
And what's amazing, guys, is this. He now finds himself swinging the club faster and the ball's going slower.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Ah. And I remember long ago when I was on Twitter, back in the old TrackMan Maestro days, good Lord, I made a tweet long, long ago, and I said, the expert golfer knows how to speed the ball up in the long game and slow it down in the short game.
Yes.
The poor golfer slows it down in the long game and speeds it up in the short game. They do. And the key for this is we want, you know, obviously there's times in a short game where you want the ball kind of hot and running. There's times when you don't want it spinning a lot. I get it. But generally speaking, in the short game, we want slow balls. We want slow ball speed. We want high spin, generally speaking. And as you said, Marty, that comes from friction. And it comes from spin loft. And now he has both. And when a player of Victor's talent level, when they get out there and they do this, you know, a few hundred times, a few thousand times, and he sees the predictability, it's game on.
I want to bring up something that's topical to the to friction, which is Shane is on a golf heater himself right now. He just played in the USAM at Cherry Hills a few weeks ago and just made a hole-in-one in, what is it, Shane, the Connecticut Mid-Am recently?
Yeah.
Tell us about your hole-in-one. What club you hit? What was the yardage? Did you tee the ball up or not? Because this kind of relates to that friction topic.
Yeah, I mean, friction was involved. It was kind of like a little shorty par three. It was about 120 yards. And I teed up sand wedge and ripped it back into the hole. So it was one of the holes in one you dream of hitting that actually spin back in, Joe. But got a lot of spin off a tee. I feel like some of the time when you tee it up, maybe I don't rip it back as much because I'm not hitting down into it. But you obviously would know more about that than I would.
Well, be careful when you just say it comes from hitting down into it. It comes from not only the hitting down part, but the loft. Remember, you got to get the spin loft to open up. But when you put the ball on the tee, you highly increase the probability of clean contact, which means you highly increase the probability of the friction, which that's where the spin rate is going to come from. So the viewers or the listeners need to be cautioned that hitting down in and of itself is not the answer, because remember, spin loft has two components. You got the down and you got the loft. I could hit down more and just take the loft with me. I need to hit down more and get the loft. I need to open that angle up. I need to open that thing up. Right, there you go. I need to open that spin loft angle up. And when you do that with friction, you're going to get that high spin rate. No question about it.
Yeah, that's one of the fun things about that topic of spin loft mountain, Joe, is that the cleaner the friction, so the better your lie, you're off a tee, your Zoysia. A lot of folks out there get fit or evaluate equipment indoors, right?
Yes.
You got really clean contact, then your maximum spin or the peak of that spin loft mountain is going to be when your spin loft is much, much greater, right? That's where you can get tons of spin off a tee.
Correct.
But then chip, you know, normal chipping and short game, And this kind of goes back, Shane, I kind of thought of that topic of Shea, Victor's caddy, talked about the wind being light and variable.
Right.
Gives him nightmares. Well, I think reading your lie around the greens, you got light and variable friction. You know, it's kind of light and variable wind. And that's where a lot of the short game in predicting the lie, reading the lie. And Joe, I think that's where you've done magic with Victor, getting to hit more down, get more clean contact, more predictable friction, a higher percentage of the time.
Yes. 100%. At the end of the day, what I think the viewer needs to understand going back is if we can increase the probability of clean contact, agree? If we can increase the probability of that, and we have, you know, a good ball and we have clean grooves, if we can increase the probability of a clean hit, assuming that we know how to manipulate spin loft, that's all this is. That's all this is. And with Victor, getting him to understand that he was too shallow, the low point was actually back, not forward. And, you know, with him, when he hit the ground behind the ball about 2,000 times in a row, what's he going to do? He started actually leaning the shaft forward, right, to not hit the ground. Well, when you lean the shaft too far forward, now you start closing the spin loft down because the bottom vector's not down enough and you're de-lofting the club, so you're shutting spin loft down. So as you know, Marty, even if you do get clean contact with a shut down spin loft, the spin's gone.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's throwing fastballs, which we don't want. So he either had flubs or chips or he had fastballs. And neither one of those are in a good situation when you're playing on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, hitting those chips where the speed comes out way hotter than your brain, you know, has wired up to do.
Think about the fear and the anxiety when that happens to you under the highest levels of pressure. Think about that. Now your brain is spinning out there, and now you're like, oh, dear God, don't miss a green. So, I mean, guys, this short game stuff, it goes all, it transcends all the way back through the bag, no question.
Yeah, Joe, I just had a question. Victor was telling us when we interviewed him that he is into playing poker right now. Have you got a chance to play any poker with him or seen him in action, and how's his game?
He has improved dramatically. He has. The only thing about Victor is he's a little impatient. He likes action. And now with his bankroll, playing for $500 is not, it doesn't keep his interest like it should.
He's hanging around with tens and he doesn't need to be. He's just like, it's fine.
Get him at about a $30,000 buy-in one night at Bellagio, and we're going to see what he's got.
Joe, I had another question for you. I know you're into sports memorabilia. What's your kind of golden goose at home right now? What do you have, or what have you purchased that's your favorite item?
Oh my God! I modestly, guys, I think I have a museum caliber pieces. I've got the jersey that Tom Brady wore. Bucks versus Eagles in October of 2021. I bought that directly from Tom's charity himself. I've got Peyton Manning's AFC Championship jersey that he wore to beat the Patriots to get to the Super Bowl. And in that game, he threw his final NFL touchdown because he did not throw one in the Super Bowl.
Yep.
Peyton saw it. He said, how the hell did you get that? And I went, I know people, Peyton. I know people. So I've got some really, really good pieces, and it's just been a hobby of mine. I enjoy the history behind it. But believe it or not, guys, some of my most important pieces are the three victories, the shirt that Victor was wearing on Sunday at Memorial, at BMW, and the Tour Championship. I have all three of those. So those are three great pieces that I'm very proud of, very special to me.
Joe, I want to give you a nod. I want to say, I think the whole golf industry owes you, you know, credit, because you can't teach all the golfers out there, but you've helped push us at Ping. You know, Victor asks you a question, you get stumped, you call us, we get stumped. Somebody's got to keep researching. It's kind of the synergy that we have, right? Of keeping pushing us on the R&D side. And I think you've influenced a lot of the golf instructors out there. And so I just want to thank you for your help to Victor, but also helping level up all the golf industry. You and Grant Waite, early adopters of TrackMan, and being practitioners, I think has really helped a lot of us. And we appreciate everything you've done for the industry and you're doing for Victor right now. So thank you for coming on and spending time with us, Joe, and sharing little insights about, you know, this great athlete that we've had the pleasure to watch here lately.
It's been incredible. And I, as I said before, I appreciate your guys' support over the last 10 years because I know I've bugged the daylights out of you. Paul doesn't even answer the phone anymore when I call. It goes straight to voicemail. No more answering. He'll call back in a week or so, but no, there's no more answering with Paul. I think I've burnt that bridge. I've bugged him so much, but no, Paul is very kind. But at the end of the day, guys, this has been a pleasure for me, and I have learned just as much from Victor as he has learned from me. And, you know, full disclosure, I've never had a player that is going to be potentially number one in the world one day. I've never had a kid that can do what this kid can do.
Yeah.
For all of you old college basketball fans out there, there was a famous coach called, his name was Adolph Rupp. He coached the Kentucky Wildcats long ago. He had a great statement, and he said, "You don't win the Kentucky Derby riding a mule." Don't ever forget that. So if you want to become a great tour instructor, find yourself a great tour player.
And Victor Hovland is definitely that. Joseph Mayo, really appreciate the time. Very interesting conversation, not just on the golf side, but the memorabilia stuff is fascinating as well. I'm now like looking behind you in your video, in your world, saying, I wonder what that image is. I wonder what's signed there. So we really appreciate the time.
Those back there are photographs from signed photographs from different actors from different movies and TV shows. And that's what that is.
Awesome. Thank you so much for the time. We really appreciate it. This is the Ping Proving Grounds podcast.